Says 3rd of July, side 1. Douglas, tell me a little bit about your background and, you know, really where you were educated and those kinds of things, just to set the scene.
I was lucky to start off with, in this sense, that the deputy borough librarian of Ilford, where I lived, was an old boy of my school. And when I was approaching school leaving age, 18 in those days, I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I went along to see him, and he said, well, we take on temporary people in this public library during the summer holidays time, when our regular staff are on holidays. Would you like to come along and see if you like it? So that's how I started. I first went to Ilford Public Library in the summer of 1937, when I was my first vacation from college, and I went there again in 38, and then when the war was imminent, I went again in 39, and because I was deferred from being called up because of my eyesight, I was on sort of extended leave from the army, and the borough librarian then gave me a permanent job, which meant that I had a job to come back to in the library at Ilford. That's how I came back. If I hadn't had that permanent job, I think I might well have gone to university again. And I managed to finish my BA in 39.
What university did you go to?
London.
To London?
Queen Mary College.
Yeah.
Which, incidentally, it is just a footnote, exists on the site where my school was actually founded in 1737, and there is a road next to Queen Mary College called Bancroft Road, and I was at Bancroft School.
Oh,
curious.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did that, and
so what happened to you during the war?
Oh, I was called up into the RAMC, Medical Corps, and made no advance whatsoever. I did become an arms corporal. And then in 1942, they started advertising for people who could speak another language for the intelligence corps. And I transferred into the intelligence corps and spent a year in Nigeria, another year on and off in hospital, and then in Germany. Towards the end of the war.
Was German your other language?
No, French actually, French. Yes. But I did learn German. Did a bit at school, and then when I was in the intelligence corps, they sent us off to Brighton College to do German studies when it looked as if the war was going to end and Germany would be losing, and we were obviously going to be in there. And my undistinguished army career in the intelligence corps ended in a fruitless search for people like Martin Bormann.
Oh, really?
That was our job, chasing up the Nazis.
Oh, okay.
And although it sounds very sort of harsh to say so, it was quite fun. And we put away a few. Nearly caught Martin Bormann on one occasion, but he just got away in time. Then I came back to Ilford Public Library, and where I met Joy, who was there, worked there as well during the war. And she said, well, I can't marry you until you get a better job. And so I went and applied for anything, although there wasn't much going, but there was this job turned up in the Metal Box Company, which was advertised, luckily for me, in the Library Association record. And so I
went. Had you done your qualifications through the ALA?
Yes, I had done. I did the ALA part one in 1940 and part two in 1946. And then I did the FLA by private study and managed to complete that. But I chose to do special libraries for the optional subject for the FLA exam on the basis of no experience, but I managed to pass that.
So you hadn't gone to Metal Box by the time?
No. I was looking though,
yeah.
And maybe I got the idea and was waiting to go there. But anyway,
so tell me about Metal Box, because that sounds quite interesting.
It was very interesting indeed,
mm-hmm.
because the information section had four people, one of whom was an ALA, but was run by a Miss Barbara Hill, who had been, she was FLA, and she'd been on the staff of Birmingham Public Library, which was a great force in those days in the library world. And could I tell you, do you want to switch off while I tell you an anecdote?
Well,
Barbara Hill, who was a splendid woman, really first rate, jolly, a mountain guide, every finger on the pulse of everything, you know, and she'd made a great success of this little library and information service in Metal Box. And she'd been engaged before the war to an Austrian whose name was Siegel, and he was a jeweler. They were separated by the war, but she left to marry Mr. Siegel. That's how I got the job.
Oh.
And last year we were in Vienna, and we were standing on the banks of the river, and I looked round and I saw Siegel on the top of a jeweler's shop. So I went in and said, you know, is Mrs. Siegel about? And she had died about 20 years before.
Oh.
And they were so interested that somebody who had known her all those years ago had turned up and found the shop just by chance.
Just by chance.
Yeah. I thought that was...
So
anyway,
you took over from her.
I took over from her, and she left and went to Austria. And the thing that was so useful to me, and of course useful to Metal Box, was this little bulletin which was called the Information Letter.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out once a fortnight, had about mimeographs, had about 18-20 items in it from the current periodicals, very much today's work. And one of my jobs was to identify these articles and write, not abstracts as I was saying, but summaries which indicated the relevance of this to the company, how it fitted in with their research or their production. And we had a lot of, it was a good library, though small, we had a lot of, about 180 of the best scientific and industrial, particularly metallurgical journals, and food technology.
Mm. So Douglas, how did you find out about what was going on in the company so that you could actually begin to tailor your abstracts to those particular interests?
Well, they had a very excellent system of short courses twice a year for new entrants to the company, and I was put on one of these within a week of, it just happened that one turned up within a week or so of my arrival. And not only was I put on the course to learn, but I had to give a lecture on the information service.
Yeah.
But fortunately, that my the chap who'd kept the place going while Barbara was away and I hadn't arrived had left a few notes and was very, very helpful. And he was a chap called Taggart, who was instrumental in the development of the aerosol, and particularly the valve that was on the top of an aerosol spray. And one of the things I wrote when I was there was a literature survey which I called Packs for Low Pressure Fingertip Dispensers. That was before they started being called aerosols wrongly.
So the Metal Box Company was a leader in the developing of this technology?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And Of course, they had this tremendous interest in food sciences through the canning industry. The canning industry itself didn't have very much in the way of research because they relied on Metal Box Company research department. And so we had a lot of food journals as well.
So was there a separate research department for the company?
Yes.
And you must have had strong liaisons across with it.
Was there. I was in it.
Oh, I see. It was your information was a part
of it. Within the research department, yes. Which was at Acton. And it had very close links with the factories, and it had a group whose job was to go to the factories all the time. That's all they did. Mm. Visit the factory, find out any problems that were in production, and bring them back to see if the research department could do a bit of research and throw any light on them. And so one of the things I had in my section, which grew by taking over another section, the correspondence registry, which of course included all the files of the lab reports and so on that had been written since the 30s. I think the department was established about early 30s and run by an Oxford science graduate. And of course that really did require pinpointing information in such a way as it could be retrieved easily, and that's how I became so convinced of the value of Ranganathan's facet analysis, which did that.
Mm. What techniques were you using at the time, though? I mean, because pre-Ranganathan.
There was a set of alphabetical subject headings. Uh-huh. And we did a lot of abstract. We had a full-time abstractor as well as what I was doing. Mm. And so the vast index was being built up of periodical articles in one room, and next door was this equally vast index being built up of the registry, the archives. Mm. I went there in 1948, and round about 1952-ish, a chap called Minchinton started writing history
of the metal box.
The tin plate industry of South Wales. Minchinton.
Tom. Okay.
Yeah. I forget what his first name. Yeah. But he spent quite a lot of time in our library doing research on this. And I can't omit to tell you of my perhaps prize coup of the time I was there. One of these manufacturing research service chaps, the liaison chap, came back with a problem. And I won't go into the details, partly because I can't remember them properly. Mm. But anyway, he put this question to me. He said, "Have we got anything that would help these people, this factory, on this problem?" And it was a lucky one, because quite soon, it's one of those things you get in information service, quite soon and without much difficulty, I did unearth something from our own registry and an article from Chemical Abstracts. And I put these two together, gave them to this chap, who took them off to the factory. Mm-hmm. And when he came back, he said, "I must tell you, they have adopted this method that you've told them about, and they reckon that will save the company so much, £10,000 a year, say, or something like that."
Oh, yeah.
That was more than the cost of my section for the year.
Really? Yeah.
So I was bonus.
Yeah.
For the rest of the year.
Did they give you a bonus?
No. Well, they did, actually, yeah. about 10 quid or something. But I always like to repeat that, because I, when people say the library and all that, say, well, that was done entirely using library techniques that I'd learned in a public library. Mm-hmm. In indexing, classification, and in retrieval.
But on a different set of documents.
Oh, yes. Much more precise and pinpointed.
Yeah.
what I think Ranganathan was the first to call it micro-information.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah. And so then I went... by this time, we had a house built in Gerard's Cross, there by an architect who was a friend of mine, to which we moved in 1952.
Oh, so you were there all that time since?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Which was very convenient for Acton, and I used to drive in from Gerard's Cross to Acton, quite a reasonable journey, although it got worse as the traffic built up from 1952. And then I began to realize that if I wanted to make progress within the metal box company, I'd have to stop doing what I like doing and do something else, even the stink to personnel management. And then the real incentive to move came from the fact that the research department itself moved to, first of all, it was going to be Swindon in those days, which was far too far. And having had our house built, we were very reluctant to move at all. Joy was there by that time. We had two children, maybe three children by that time. And she'd got her circle of friends, and was very reluctant to move, Gilman School, all those sorts of things. And so I thought I'd better look for another job. And I was hankering after something more in my humanities line.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very curious circumstance, another one of these anecdotes which you might like to exclude if you want to. I was asked by the head of the North London Polytechnic School of Librarianship if I would join with the head of the University of London Library, who was then a chap called Dr. Pafford.
Oh, yes. J.H.S.P. Pafford.
That's right, J.H.P. Pafford.
I know his book on library cooperation.
Oh, well, then I must show you something, because I gave the first Pafford Memorial Lecture last year.
Really?
Yes. Anyway, he was going to do university libraries, and I was asked to do special libraries. And we came back from Camden Town on the bus. And talking on the bus, he said, "You're a special librarian. Do you know anybody who would be suitable for our Institute of Education?" I said, "Well, I don't think so. What kind of a job is it?" So he told me, and I realised then the most suitable person I could think of was me. And it so happened, though I didn't really know this at the time, that one of the staff there had actually worked with me in Ilford Public Library before the war.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And another one had been married to somebody who worked with me in Ilford Public Library before the war. So I had a very good reception there. And when on the interview, I explained why I thought that my experience at Metal Box would be useful. It was that the Institute of Education then was the sort of focus point in the university for a number of teacher training colleges in the southeast of England. So I said, well, one of the things I've been doing is acting as a focus point for research and development for a number of outstations, such as your teacher training colleges have to you. And so they gave me the job, and I was there for 21 years, and a wonderful time there. Yeah. It wasn't one of the world's great places, because education is not one of the world's great subjects, but within the field of education and educational studies, it was the world's centre. There were only one other place, and that was Columbia.
Columbia, Teachers College.
Yes. At that time. And so I had this terrific international list of contacts with education librarians around the world, which proved very valuable on more than one occasion.
Were you there when Bill Taylor was he was principal at one point, wasn't he?
Yes.
He was director of the institute, yes, and he was also principal of the university.
Yeah.
And Bill possibly contributed to the downgrading of the principal's job, because if ever there had been a man who could fill Logan's shoes, it was Bill Taylor. But he said, well, this is a non-job and I want nothing of it.
Mm-hmm.
So he went off to be Vice Chancellor of Health. Yes. You knew him, did you?
I did. He was on the one of the other people on the International Editorial Board of World Book, which I sat on for 10 years or so.
Yes.
And so I used to meet him at all sorts of meetings, and so he was part of
the world.
And Leonie Kramer from our place was the other, and there's these two major gurus of Leonie from Australia, him from the UK, and they did not see eye to eye at all.
Okay.
Which was interesting. So that's how I knew him. And he'd been at Hull, and I think, I'm not sure where he went after that.
It was Huddersfield, I think.
But anyway, let's come back to you.
Yeah.
So,
I was very fond of Bill Taylor. He was a good lad.
Mm. So,
we had this report on the University of London library system. Very good report. It was chaired by the head of the Institute for Latin American Studies, a chap called Robin Humphreys, who really was a world figure in Latin American studies. And that report recommended the setting up of a coordinating body for the libraries of the University of London, and the appointment of a director of Central Library Services with three deputies, one to run the University Library, one to run the Library Resources Coordinating Committee, and one which I myself inserted, because we had one of the subcommittees was an information services committee, which I was the reporter.
Mm.
We had an information services deputy as well, who was Alida Vickery, and she was a whiz bang Berliner. She really did a lot of good within the university for information work by college librarians, particularly the scientific ones.
You've mentioned that she'd done something else with metallurgy, was that?
In Imperial.
Yes,
she's published under this name.
So she was then Gralewska, was it?
Gralewska.
G-R-A. G-R-A.
L-E-W-S-K-I. Or A, S-K-A. That's female.
Yeah.
Alina Gralewska,
so she
Imperial College.
And of course Imperial College was one of the components of the university, wasn't it?
Is it switched off?
It's switched on now. Did you want me to switch it on?
Yes. I managed to get Alina Vickery to take this post of Head of Information Services, and she really introduced all the databases, and I was able to get money to fit her section up. And
this was when you had become the university director of the university and Goldsmiths librarian.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when was that, Douglas?
Well, what happened there was that Don Richnell, who had been Pafford's deputy for many years, then went to Reading. But when Pafford retired, Richnell went back to be the Goldsmiths librarian, and he was the first director of Central Library Services and Goldsmiths librarian.
Right.
And
so he would have gone to the British Library when it was
created
in 73-4.
Was in effect the head of the BM Library, the reference division of the British Library. Yeah.
So when he went to there,
Kenneth Garside, who at that time was librarian of King's College, he took that appointment, but he was only there for 4 years, which perhaps was a mistake in retrospect. And then when he retired, I was rung up and asked if I would put my name in for the the post which I did and got it.
You're telling me it's the longest title.
That's right.
Any go?
Director, Central Library Services and Goldsmiths Librarian. And it's Goldsmiths S apostrophe.
Oh, okay.
It was more than one Goldsmith. I was always very keen on that. My secretary used to joke about it.
So, I mean, it was while you were then in that position that the ordination sort of began.
Yeah.
And
Though, what splendid thing that Don Richel did was to get the American firm Research Publications. They do microfilms of whole collections.
Yes.
I think it's called RPI, Research Publications Incorporated. Anyway, they wanted to film the whole of the Goldsmiths Library, full text. And that was going on, started by Original, and it was going on still when I was there.
What was the collection? I mean,
it's the best collection of the history of economics, economic history literature in the world.
Right.
In fact, it was given to the university by the Goldsmiths Company in 1903, and thereafter the university librarian was always known as the Goldsmiths Librarian. That unfortunately has now stopped because people were saying, oh, it's very confusing with Goldsmiths College and so forth.
But the university presumably kept up the collection, building up.
Yes.
So that microfilming project, that's interesting because we forget in the digital era that there were in fact this massive conversion of corpora.
That's right.
Of textual corpora in microform, and so this was one of them that I was not aware of. And so it was completed, I take it, as microfilm.
Yes. Yeah. There was a catalogue. The catalogue of the Goldsmiths collection was published as a book in Pafford's time by P. Hazel, was the inspirer of that. And the film, the RPI film, is offered together with a library of a similar kind at Harvard, which I'm afraid I've forgotten the title. It's something like Frisch. French, something like that.
I should know that, and I can't. I'm afraid I can't
remember either. But
so that was a joint project.
It was a joint project by RPI.
Yeah.
We had nothing much to do with Harvard.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say, because I knew one or two of the librarians of Harvard, and of course I knew the last one very well, Dick Tinelaro. I knew him well.
Yeah. So how many volumes were involved in this project?
I should think probably 200,000.
God, yes.
I would think better off the top of my head.
I mean, what was interesting?
That was a post. But, very, very pleasant fellow.
What led to the creation of the lecture? More lecture for him so long after he would have lived.
Well, yes. There is an organisation called the Friends of the University of London Library, of which I was a committee member, and then chairman, and then president, and because I'd been the director. And it was one of our proposals. We thought it would be nice if his contribution had been recognised. He didn't publish a great deal. He's a library corporational book and lots of things. But his main contribution, I think, was that he edited The Winter's Tale for the Auden Shakespeare collection.
Yes.
And spent a lot of time on that.
Mm.
And his introduction's very interesting.
But he would have been dead, was he?
Yes. Mind you, he was 96. So... in fact, he died in 96. He was as old as the century.
Yes.
So not all that long ago. It's as far as, for me, that's only yesterday.
Well, you Goldsmiths librarians seem to... The record is fairly good, isn't it? I mean...
Well, unfortunately, there were two or three... After Pafford, Richmond was there for some years, But then there was a succession of short-term people, of which I was one, I'm afraid.
How long were you?
I was only there 5 years, which wasn't enough time.
Yeah.
If you switch that off.
Well, so the bulk then of your career there at the University of London was really at the Institute of Education.
Yes.
And then those 5 years.
5 years, yes.
Director of the whole thing.
And by virtue of being on the committee which established the Library Resources Coordinating Committee, that's how I became very much at the centre of university library development from way back. And that was another accident, really. We had a little group which was called SCOLL, Standing Conference of Librarians of Libraries of the University of London, SCOLL, more or less founded by Pafford. And it so happened that the year that Humphreys Committee was established to look at this scene, I was chairman of SCOLL.
Mm-hmm.
So they put the chairman of SCOLL on the Humphreys Committee, and it happened to be me. And I then got them to establish an information services subcommittee, which was chaired by a professor of electrical engineering at King's, and a very powerful and valuable professor of chemistry from University College. So we got King's and University College both committed to the information services.
What's interesting about that, though, is you've got one where you've got potential avenue of computing coming in.
Yes.
And with the chemistry, where you have special needs within the management of the literature,
right.
The complexities of the literature.
Yes.
So, was there some at that time discussion of the potentials of computerization and the development of online services?
Oh yes, for Alina Vickery.
Yes. Oh no, but I meant in terms of your committee.
Well, yes, because I put it there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was saying that what we need to do is to have, let's put it another way, to take advantages of developments in computerized retrieval and dissemination of individual items of information as well as conglomerates like books.
Mm.
And of course what Alina had been doing in Imperial College was exactly that. And of course she had this dynamic personality as well. Mm. And everybody was saying that once she had retired it was not the same. Mm. And being in the position of director, I was able to influence the way in which her own individual technology developed, so she was able to get a lot of the latest equipment, even if only in an experimental sort of level.
Mm.
So I was very proud of that, actually.
Mm. Mm. Well, I mean, because that's such a seminal time.
Yes.
So let's come to the CRG too, because and how that formed. And did you ever meet? Well, no. Let's talk about how it formed, because then I want to ask you if you ever met Ranganathan.
Oh, many times. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, what happened with the CRG? That's there's accounts of that in the big encyclopedia,
yes.
Which I wrote myself, actually. And what happened briefly was that almost immediately after I joined Metal Box, the Royal Society set up a scientific information conference in 1948. This was a result of the 1946 Empire Scientific Conference. Now at the 48 conference, you'll remember that Burnell made this revolutionary proposal of one great national centre for collecting literature of everything in the world, which of course eventually came to pass at Boston Spa.
Well, I was going to say also Venedig.
Oh, well, absolutely.
Given his communist connection.
That's right, that's absolutely right. And for that very reason, his proposal was more or less howled down, particularly by the editors of the journals, who, for some reason or other, thought this was a threat to their autonomy, because they... one of the facets of the idea, Bernal's proposal, was that journal publishing as such should decline in favour of the individual publication of individual papers, which were then deposited in a centre and reproduced and distributed. So anyway, one of the things that came up at the 48 conference was the need for a new good classification of science, the sciences. At that time, A.J. Wells was the editor of the newly established, just established, British National Bibliography. And Bernal asked Wells if he could do something about classification research. Well, I knew Wells because he had worked at Ilford before the war as well. And I'd met him many times. We were old friends, in fact. We did often discuss classification. So he approached me. There was Jack Mills, who was teaching, Derek Langridge, who was teaching, Brian Vickery, who was at that time, Brian was still at ICI Acres, the division which was the research, basic research. There was arm of ICI. They just did basic research, not necessarily devoted to any particular factory or institution of the company. So we formed that. We had some chap from the Chartered Insurance Institute, a chap from the British Gas Board, Dennis Arnold, who was then librarian at ICI Paint Division in Slough, round the corner from where I lived, and about 15, 20 others, Kathleen Watkins, who was the science librarian at UCL. So we started the classification research group, and during those years, several of us, myself, Vickery, Langridge, Jean Aitchison, possibly others, maybe the insurance chap as well. Anyway, several of us had to devise detailed classification schemes of our own for our own industries. Jason did diamond technology, for example. Do many people know that? He did a great scheme for diamond technology as a consultant to the industry. Mm-hmm. And Brian did soil science, and I did occupational safety and health and packaging.
Magda Whitrow did one too.
Magda did the history of science. Yes.
Who did the Library Association? The one for
One person whom I ought to have mentioned right at the start was Bernard Palmer, who at that time was the education officer of the Library Association and was also a close friend of Jack Wells. And those two contributed the first exposition of faceted classification to be published in the UK. It was called Fundamentals of Library Classification.
It was a manifesto of your group.
Yeah.
It was published by Vickery, wasn't it?
That's right,
In J. Dock, I think.
Yes. Well, that was from the Dorking Conference.
Oh, okay, so it's quite a bit later.
Yeah. But the wheels of fate, like the DNA helix, double helix. Bernard Palmer had served in the war in India, where he met Ranganathan. And he'd been in Madras for a long time and got to know Ranganathan well, visited and so on. And he came back full of Ranganathan's ideas on classification, which he then more or less sold to Jack Wells. And the principles of facet analysis were put into operation using the Dewey Decimal Classification right from the start in the BMB. And I must quote one of the American reviewers of this volume, who said this is a new departure, a national bibliography for the UK, which is classified by Dewey, and the subject index is a dream. Always remember that quotation, because it was done exactly on Ranganathan's principle of change procedure indexing. So that was a tremendous boost to us. And so we went on, and for the first few years we were very much concerned with devising schemes in given specialist subjects, like Jason's diamond technology, Brian's soil science, and my packaging. And I also did one in the Institute of Education for the field of community development, with which they had a department of community development, with special reference to India and Africa, where many of the staff had actually served as education officers.
Now, these classifications that you were developing, were they actually put into practice and used?
Oh, yes.
And they were used in what contexts?
Well, as far as I know, the occupational safety and health classification, which was done in 1956, is still in use. And that was used as a basis for classifying abstracts, which were then printed like Library of Congress cards and made available all around the world. And there was a huge, I was there for 6 weeks. I went there ostensibly to look at their in-house information service. The library of the ILO was being run on very traditional lines by a chap who had been the librarian of the League of Nations Library before the war and had kept on, such libraries existed during the war, which was in Canada. And he came back, and it was very, very conventional, very traditional. And the departments of, like the Occupational Safety and Health Department, were beginning to fret about this and were beginning to build up their own little collections around about the building. And a very far-sighted chap called Pairo, who was an Argentinian, Rudolfo Pairo, P-A-Y-R-O, he's probably long gone, but he invited the librarian of the LSE to, well, I don't say he invited, he was instrumental in inviting the LSE librarian to go and look at the LSE library itself.
But you mean the ILO library?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which was the League of Nations library before the war, and it just continued like that. Very big library, but perhaps I should not say, but I do say, static. And Rodolfo Pairo, seeing all these departments, he wasn't in the library or anything like that, but he could see that this was endangering the library service as a whole by fragmentation. And he asked Geoffrey Woolwich, who was the librarian of LSE, who'd been there to look at the library, if he could recommend somebody who would go out there and look at their documentation service and devise a classification for it. So Woolwich asked me, and I put it to the Metalbox people, the research department, and they said, yes, I could go there on unpaid leave. So
I presumably then the UN paid you, I mean.
Yes. So I was there for 6 weeks in the first instance, wrote a report and devised a framework classification, got fair detail. Then I was very fortunate in that the Occupational Safety and Health Division took to this very much so, because they were then interested in starting up this card abstracting service, and the idea of having a nice notation to put on it, classified notation to put on it, appealed to them very much so. And that went on, and I ought to have found out whether it's still going. Can't believe that it isn't, but
it would now be an automated
service. It would now be automated, yes, and I know that would be the case, because next door to the ILO itself was another small institute. I forget the exact title, but it was something like Institute for Labour Studies Research, say. And that was, that had its own library, which was in charge of a very good, a very nice chap called Thompson, American. And when I left and the previous League of Nations librarian retired, George Thompson was appointed to his post, so he took over the whole thing and immediately began the mechanization process. And I remember standing on a hill, they were going to build a new building for the ILO, which has since been done, but the old building from pre-war times was down by the lake, long building like that. And I remember George standing on with me on a hill on top of it, and look at that, he said, it's just like an IBM card. Anyway, he did that, and I think George retired to Switzerland, where he had a very nice house in the on the French side of the lake. Very nice.
Douglas Foskett, side two. That's sort of reminding you of an anecdote.
Yes. We had, or I had experimented with syllabic, with literal notations, with the packaging scheme, and I devised one system which meant that the facets could be indicated by capital letters, and the terms within the facets by small letters. And as I worked with this and talked to people about it, it became obvious that where a three-letter symbol could be pronounced, it would be pronounced. And so I came up with the idea, why not make it all notation pronounceable, these three-letter symbols pronounceable, so that instead of having, say, B-U-D-S-U-R-K-A-B, you'd just say Betzer Cab, and that would be that, and it would be different from 6 to 8.7918023, which is the Dewey for packaging. Anyway, I put that into effect sometime later, but I don't think it really lasted, because of course you reduced your size of your notation considerably if you introduce a vowel into the second place. A nice thought though, I like that one. But anyway, to get back to the anecdote, it turned out, and there was the problem, that in a faceted scheme, the most specific topics are right at the end of the schedule. So if you start A, B, C, D, E, the most specific topics begin with X, Y, Z, and not with A, B, C. So in a document subject, you would have X, Y, Z, N, B, G, A, B, C, and so on, instead of A, B, C, X, Y, Z, and so on. Reverse order, in fact. This worried me a lot, and I couldn't think how to overcome this. And I went and looked at a collection, which was more of an archive collection, stored in metal cabinets, big drawer, four drawer metal cabinets. And that had been notated, or had been arranged, by a Japanese, who naturally read from right to left. And I didn't bother any more about that. So that was that. And then the packaging thing came up later with the European Packaging Federation. And they asked me to, they saw the scheme that I'd done for the metal box registry stuff, the correspondence, lab reports, and very specific topics. That was going along in full swing, and the printed version came out just as I left metal box, but it was carried on by John Rippon, who took over my place at metal box and I told you became a member of the council of the Institute of Information Scientists, in spite of having no science degree, but a very good chap. Now that's dead. Terrible.
Now, well, this is kind of the CIT, so it's got you folk are making up these classifications.
Yes.
And they are, in fact, being used. When did Ranganathan come over?
Ranganathan came over in 1948.
48?
Yes. At the invitation of the Society for Visiting Scientists in London. And he gave a very good lecture at ASLIB, in sort of sponsored by the Society of Visiting Scientists. And it was called A Self-Perpetuating Scheme of Classification. And it was published in a very early volume of JDoc after the war. And then the JDoc merged with another publication, which was the publication of the British Society for International Bibliography, BSIB.
Pollard and Bradford.
Pollard and Bradford, yes. And then, of course, Hope Fairthorne and Erkin, who were also in the BSIB. Yes, that was in the early days of Erkin's career.
That was in the Science Museum?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where was the,
the RIA in Farnborough. Yeah, in Farnborough,
yeah.
Yes. But he had I remember this very clearly, he had two lectures published in the BSI Proceedings, I think it was called.
Yes, BSI Proceedings.
During the war. Yeah. And one was called The Mathematics of Classification, and the second one was called The Classification of Mathematics. And they were both in the same volume of the BSI Proceedings. And did you ever meet Bob Fairfield?
Yeah,
oh, he was a card.
Yeah.
Oh, a wonderful chap. And of course, a very, very eminent mathematician who had without doubt made considerable contributions during the war, though nobody would know about them, because they were the RAE in Royal Aircraft Establishment.
Yeah.
And so Bob Fairthorne, of course, was one of the first members of the CRG as well. And he and Vickery were very good in cooperation and exchange of views.
Was Vickery's background as a chemist?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. He had been in industrial chemistry during the war.
Mm.
And then he had got the job of librarian at Acres, ICI Acres, which was named after Sir Wallace Acres, who'd been the director of research for ICI for many years. And, rather a sort of good thing for ICI to set up such a place. Pure research. And a lot of their advances, of course, came from Acres. And,
coming back to Ranganathan and that lecture, Fairthorne and Urquhart were, you were mentioning...
In the context of Bob Burford.
Yeah.
Well, Ranganathan came over and gave this lecture and, of course, was entertained by Wells, Jack Wells, at his house in Ilford.
Yeah.
And he invited a number of the other members of staff to meet Ranganathan at his house. And I remember very vividly Ranganathan demonstrating a facet analysis of the subject of Mickey.
Yeah,
all these library girls sitting around.
Oh, I see.
A gob, you see. And he did a classification meeting. And then he came to a CRG meeting and had great discussions with Eric Coates, of course, who was then the chief subject cataloguer of BNB. Yeah. And produced his, well, I still think is probably the best book on cataloguing ever written. Subject heading. Something from the headings of procedure. Yes. And I
and should be reprinted, really, but I don't think it ever will be, because it got bumped down with his thought system of ordering. Shame. But anyway, he's still there. Jack's still there. I'm still there. Derek, a language, alas, has just died, and we shall miss him very, very severely, because he was a very strong advocate for Classification in the Humanities, which was his book. You know, he produced, Beckley, myself, and Langridge produced the three books, Classification Index in Science, Social Science, and Humanities. They made a trilogy. And he was very good on the theoretical basis of subject analysis, very much influenced by the work of modern
professors of education, professors of the philosophy of education, who have got their own ideas about the grouping of natural phenomena and human products as part of natural phenomena. Forms of knowledge was Derek's theme, and he reckoned, I can't really tell you accurately because I would need to have the paper in front of me.
So let's come back to
one. Yes, let me just give you one instance of the sort of, one instance of Derek's approach. He would say that whereas most classification people would take a book on the history of science and would say, well, obviously that's the book that goes with the science books, Derek would say, no, it doesn't go there at all.
It's a history book. History is a particular form of knowledge, and it's not science. So it must go with the history of books, and the history of science, and the history of medicine, and the history of art, and the history of this and that, are all in the form of knowledge known as history. That, I think, is an epitome of Derek's approach. He had about half a dozen, six or eight of these forms
of knowledge.
Science was one. History was one. And anyway, then that was to get back to the point of the CRG, the crucial point was when all of us compilers of these special schemes, we had all come across the one same problem. We all needed a reservoir of the rest of knowledge to draw. Like in packaging, there is the facet called PAX, which is anything from aspirins to battleships. Now we didn't want to have a classification of the whole of everything as one facet of my classification scheme. When I came to do education, which has been published as part of the Bliss scheme, subject of the curriculum is a similar case. Anything can be taught. So we don't want a classification of everything in one facet of the education classification. What we need is to say, go and draw on this, what we called an classification, which was a vast conglomeration of every term you could think of, but not necessarily a classification of it. The conclusion of all this was that we needed a new, good, general classification scheme, which was not simply a collection of specialist schemes. It had its own internal structure and methods of analysis and synthesis and use. So that's how we all came to be involved with the new edition of Bliss. And Jack Mills was teaching at the Northwest Poly, as it was, and became the University of North London, and he got he used to teach his students that way, by getting them to make their own schemes in their own fields of interest, where their degree or whatever it might be. He did, I don't think Jack produced one scheme of his own. Eric did a lot of work on additions to Dewey, I don't know if you remember, but for many years at one point when Eric was still there, Eric Coates was still there, the BNB developed a technique of enlarging Dewey by brackets brackets one, and then verbal extension. And the verbal extensions enabled the chain indexing procedure to be carried out automatically, better than using the notation, which is what Rangel's technique did, of course. So then we had, I happened to see in one of the scientific magazines, typed like Chemical Engineering News, say, a note that NATO was interested in a new classification of the sciences. So I wrote to NATO and said, sort of strange that you should come to this conclusion. We in the classification research group have reached this conclusion ourselves, but we have no resources. So they invited me over, and I went to NATO in Paris and saw their head of science, and I persuaded him that we could do something if we had the money, and he gave us £5,000. Mm-hmm. So we called a conference, and there was a little pamphlet, I don't know whether you will have seen that, there was a little pamphlet called something like Classification for a General Index Language. Well, I've got a copy of that somewhere. It was published by the Library Association, in which we outlined our thoughts about the relationship between specialist schemes and general schemes, and what the structure of a general scheme could look like, and what sort of techniques would be needed. So then we used this £5,000. You may like to delete this, but it will be interesting for you to refer back to. We then recruited an excellent girl called Helen Pates, who had been a student at UCL, was a classic graduate.
Did you say Bates or
Pates? Pates, yes, mm. Helen Pates. And she wrote two or three really good papers, including one on the classification of politics, which was subsequently incorporated into the new risk classification. And she really was excellent, and then she went and got married. And she married a fellow graduate of UCL, and they moved to Cambridge, and she said she couldn't carry on. And so this was only 6 months into our scheme. And of course, £5,000 in those days was quite a decent sum. We could afford to employ somebody for a year.
Oh, really?
Full time, you see. And who did we get but bloody Derek Austin? Who at that time was employed by the BNB and was rather favoured by Jack Wells. And he didn't know anything about plastid classification. I can remember him coming to my office in the Institute of Education and sitting there and having a lesson on plastid analysis and that sort of thing. And what did he do? He went and off and invented Precy and made an internationally famous name for himself out of our money, but to no advantage of our scheme whatsoever. And where's Precy now? Gone with the wind, which is what it was. I was absolutely, you can imagine, I'd gone to that, I had myself organized this £5,000, right? And I could not deviate, I could not make him deviate from this path, which is of course an alphabetical system. And everybody thought it was the bee's knees, and it's dead. Nobody knows. Never heard of it now.
No, it was so prominent though, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes. And I think Well, no, Tony gave some time to it in his subject approach. But that's where that went. Now, so if we had £5,000 now, or the equivalent,
yeah,
we could finish the Bliss scheme.
Yeah.
It's really heartbreaking for me, that.
So nothing came from it then, that you could send back to NATO?
No, nothing. We sent back the conference proceedings, and the LA also published a bigger research pamphlet, number 2, which contained quite a lot of CRG minute stuff.
Okay.
So we sent that, and they got something out of it, but what they didn't get was a new general classification of the sciences, which is almost complete now, which having been done with everybody's part-time.
Right. So this work on Bliss, the second edition of Bliss, has been going on then for quite a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
Is it in any general use now?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is a Bliss Classification Association.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's much in use in the States.
You never hear about it in the States.
No, you never hear about it, although he's an American, of course.
Yes, originally, yes.
Astonishing that, but I think that it's I've got a little theory of my own that the basic American philosophy of life is the exaltation of the individual above any systems. Therefore, alphabetical subject cataloging is the natural library concomitant of that philosophy.
Metcalfe's specific entry.
Specific entry, yes, yes. How specific is specific, yes. Yes. That title of Don Swanson's paper nearly came into my head just now. It's gone again. It was something like poverty of information.
Oh, there's a recent paper on not the fallibility, but there were inadequacies or something. There was a series of, and he numbered a number of inadequacies of information.
Yes,
yeah.
That sounds like that, but it wasn't recent. It could have been a good long time ago.
For most of us, you know, Ranganathan was a name and very important and influenced people's thinking, and you know, in the case of Metcalfe, by way of opposition,
yes,
and calumny,
yes.
And for CRG by way of stimulation and
yes,
so on.
Yes.
But again, I think he's dropping out of sight, especially in America, from the younger generation.
Well, and I know what you mean, but I think he has maybe achieved the fate of all the best inventions, that he has become embedded so much in the consciousness that people have forgotten that he invented it.
Mm.
I always found that talking to the people like the packagers and the occupational safety people and people like that, I always found that they could understand it immediately, the facet of answers, both the material, the energy, the historical time, the geographical location, and the end product. And of course, the systems theory of von Bertalanffy, mm-hmm, and Erwin Laszlo and those people, there's an American in Chicago whose name I can't remember at the moment, who also has joined in this. There's a lot of books on general systems theory.
Yeah.
Well, it's facet analysis, mm-hmm, absolutely. And as I wrote a paper myself for an Indian Library Association conference years ago called The Personality of the Personality Facet, in which I said that here is general systems theory. And general systems theory centers around the idea of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts, in short. And that's what facet analysis is. And the personality of any subject field is the end product in technology. Technology is an easy way to demonstrate this. Of course, Derek was very good at that in the humanities, the more academic subjects, which I'm for, well, in his classification of the humanities, he does this. And he used it in his jazz classification, for example. And so I think that the idea of these categories of material, I mean, as old as the Greeks,
sure.
But Ranganathan was the first one to demonstrate that you could do it with terms in a system of classification. And I think that it's got so much embedded into people, they may not call it facet analysis, but the technique of subject analysis in that way, that people take it for granted if they're interested, and that's what they do.
Yes, I'm sure these object-oriented databases, whatever they're called, employ a process very similar.
Yes, cruder, but similar, yeah. And so I wish we could get into that sort of area, but I'm now... if I were 20 years younger, that's where I would be. I would be doing these classifications all over the place and putting them on the internet and have a website saying class.com or whatever.
Yeah, you should think of it. Never too late, Douglas.
Well, I've got other things, yeah. Like my ancestor research. I've got myself back to the Civil War, our Civil War. There were Foskets involved in the Civil War, and there's a village that I just visited called Foscott in North Buckinghamshire, Foscott Manor. Unfortunately, I don't think I am entitled to own it, because my grandfather in that era was the last son, not the first. And I've taken the photograph of it.
So you have it sold now.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of...
That's right.
So what about, just coming back to Ranganathan, I don't know why I'm dwelling on Graham at the moment. So what was he like? I mean, as a personality?
Oh, he was tremendous fun.
Was he?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. He was full of laughter. He had all the arrogance of genius, I suppose, I would say. And not so much with us, but with his Indian friends and colleagues, especially those who were on his staff, he behaved in a, what you can only call an imperial way. But he was absolutely dedicated to librarianship, and particularly classification. And he has a very fine son called Yogeshwar, who is an engineer, lives in Luxembourg. Excellent chap.
Luxembourg.
Yeah. He's married to a Swiss, anyway, a continental European girl. They have a son. And so Ranganathan has a grandson, grown-up grandson, and in fact, at this very conference in Delhi, Ranganathan's grandson came and spoke about his grandfather.
Oh.
Yes, it was really lovely. I wish that had been recorded somehow to hear the young man, whose name I really, again, escapes me, talking about his grandfather and how he used to play with him as a little boy.
Yeah.
And I remember one time when I was in Geneva at the ILO, Ranganathan lived in Zurich for 2 years,
yeah.
And I visited him there. Yeah, and Yogeshwar was there, his son, and he took us around, drove us around Zurich while he was there, and it was very interesting and engaging to see Yogeshwar putting his old man in his place, Pa, he called him.
But I take it that the son was driving the car, not
Ranganathan. Yeah, no, Ranganathan would never have had it. Ranganathan would go like that and expect the car to be there to take him. But utterly dedicated, he lived a most austere life, like Gandhi, who he admired greatly, of course, and never spent anything on himself. And I forget, I think it might have been Bernard Palmer who told me this from his recollection of the home in the war, that one day Ranganathan came home from his work when Yogeshwar was a little boy, and on the wall Yogeshwar had written, "Librarians may be very good for humanity, but they're not much good for their family." I don't know whether those are the exact words, but pretty nearly the exact words, yes.
We don't have an account of Ranganathan's response.
No, I'm sure he would have laughed, laughed. But, now, to come back to the point, Yogeshwar has now written a life of Ranganathan. It's not yet published, and perhaps I could ring him up and let you know.
I'd be very interested to see it.
You would.
I'm a bit, I mean,
you would indeed.
Not from any sense of having any role in publication. I mean, I presume, does he have a publisher?
I don't know.
No. But just out of general interest in the subject matter.
For what you're doing?
Yeah.
I'm sure it will be most useful.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's joy. Arriving back.
I'm sharp hearing, don't I?
Yeah. I used it. Computer printer.
Mm.
And I've made some contributions to the book, much as we've been talking about now.
Yeah.
And I just don't know. I expect that it may be published by his own or his mother's trust. You know, Ranganathan devoted all his money to the Sarada Ranganathan Trust.
Yes, I've seen that.
That's his wife, Sarada Ranganathan. Mm. And it was in fact his second wife, because he was married in childhood, as the Indian.
Oh, arranged marriage.
Arranged marriage, yes. I don't know what happened to his first wife, but I don't even recall. I don't think she was Yogeshwar's mother. T.R. Yogeshwar, you know, their system of naming children is different from ours.
Mm.
It's the first T stands for Triplicane, which is where he was born, and the S of S.R. Ranganathan is Shiali, which is where Ranganathan was born. Then the second is there, so his name is Triplicane Ranganathan Yogeshwar. So he's always known as T.R. Yogeshwar in the Western fashion. So Yogeshwar is, in fact, if he were a Christian, it would be his Christian name.
Yeah.
Yes. Excellent fellow, very, very nice chap, very well balanced and well adjusted to his father. His fame, his international status. He was a research professor, one of the 12 in India, and which for the library profession was a tremendous honour, almost like being a member of the Order of Merit here. And yes, as I say, but he was great fun to be with, and would always listen and take note carefully. And he was a great one for the early morning before breakfast walk. I did that several times with him during the Dorking Conference. Got up early to have a walk round the place before breakfast.
Did he wear a Western dress or did he wear a
dress? No, never.
What was it?
Always, always, yes. Yeah.
So let's go on then to, I suppose, the Dorking Conference is in a very... It's a milestone.
Yes.
Rather than a
Well, it is, because we got As I said, Jean Garfield was there. Helen Brownson was there. And she at that time was something to do with the Ford Foundation, I believe.
Or at NSF?
Was it?
I'm not sure.
Well, she was to do with giving out money.
NSF, I think.
Oh, NSF. Oh, yes.
I think she, you know, published those, yeah.
Yes. And Barbara Kyle, of course, ought to mention Barbara, who is a dear friend of mine and died much too soon.
Mm.
And she was the social sciences person in the CRG and did a lot of work on analysing the social sciences, seeing whether our theory of integrative levels would fit in with the social sciences. I firmly believe it does throughout, though I've many an argument with Derek Langridge over that.
Tell me what the theory of integrative levels is.
Well, it's very similar to general systems theory, though it goes back a long way further to a paper by Joseph Needham,
mm-hmm.
who was the great China yeah. expert at Cambridge mm-hmm. before the war. He published a book of essays called Time, the Refreshing River, and in it was this theory of integrative levels, which was that very much like passive analysis, that individual items or entities form relationships with one another, and by virtue of those relationships they can combine to form one entity which is greater than all of them, but which consists of all of them and their relationships, nothing else. Like the example, crude example I use is of a bicycle. A bicycle, basically, you could start with bits of rubber and metal and so forth, and out of those you can make a pedal. You can also make a wheel. So you get a pedal and a wheel, and with a bit of steel you can make bars and things, and all of these you can lie on the ground as separate entities. Each one does nothing much except be itself until it's put into relationship, a permanent relationship with something else.
Mm.
Like the pedal goes with the axle, and the axle goes with the wheel, and the wheel goes with the frame. And when you've put all these things, these separate entities together, they make a machine for transferring rotary motion to horizontal motion. So you get the whole bicycle. And of course, in the classification, in the classification of bicycle manufacture, the bicycle is the personality.
Okay.
And iron and steel and rubber and plastic, for what I know, are the materials. Nuts and bolts are the parts, and those the various categories, these things drop naturally into various categories, and that's what general systems theory is, that they talk in abstract terms of wholes
and entities in relationship which make new wholes, which by virtue of the relationship between them make the whole more than the sum of its parts. So, and once you destroy the relationships, you're just left with a heap of parts with no personality at this level. But at the level below, each one of those parts is its own personality.
Yeah.
And so there you come. I apply this. I demonstrate. I've got a piece of paper that you can spare, and I demonstrate this in classes. Now,
okay.
Well, there was a second 50 years after.
Yeah.
A few years ago.
Why was the Dorking Conference so important, do you think?
Well, I think it was the first time that a group of
individuals like those people, each known as ploughing a furrow of their, almost of their own invention, without perhaps knowing that there were others a lot working in the same area, got together. They were, we selected them, and we didn't always get the right people. Helen Brownson said that we made a big mistake in the United States chap. I forget who he was, but she said you ought to have had the IBM man. Goodness. Oh dear.
Who was the American chap?
You know, I can't remember, but he was a very nice chap, but he wasn't at all contributory to the final. Well, I could keep them at that, because I expect that's one of the... I've lost some of my books in the move, I'm afraid.
That's easy to look at.
I've got that one, I'm sure. Yeah, so Helen Brownson was there, the Crolier was there, Cordonnier, who had done stuff in the war for the French Ministry of one of the industries, an engineer he was. It was very small, and Beric Sayers came and opened the conference.
He'd be very old.
He was very old by then. In fact, he only lasted a year or two longer than that.
Pauline, was she the reporter or something? Pauline Cochrane?
Pauline, yes.
Etherham,
yes.
She's Etherham.
Pauline did something, yes. De Grolier gave the final general sort of report, analytical report of the conference.
So I missed talking to him. He died apparently a couple of years ago.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh.
Maybe.
We were wondering about that with the McElwains the other day. We didn't know.
I think so. I think Sylvie Fies Scriber, who was doing work, acknowledged him and his contribution in something or other. And then I think somebody said he died, so it might have only been a year ago or 2 years.
But how awful that we didn't see that.
Well, I didn't see any obituary notices.
No, neither did I.
And you'd think you would, because he was so well known.
Oh, absolutely.
For such a long time.
He was one of the best known in the world. Because he dabbled in so many fields.
And had been since the war, too. I mean, it was a long,
Yes, but of course he was famous in bibliographical circles in the 30s. He had been to one of the first conferences in around 1932, bibliographical conferences, which involved people from the USSR.
Because I think he was also active in the creation of UFOP, the Union
Union Française des Organismes de la Documentation.
So,
well, to see de Grolier and Ranganathan, one another, that really was...
Oh, so they actually had encounters?
Oh, they had it. Oh, certainly, because both were at the Dawkins Conference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So how did that work?
Well... You mean the conference or the confrontation?
No, the confrontation, because they couldn't be more different, you think.
Well, they didn't really ever clash.
Mm.
They seemed to accept the other's point of view, and as a sort of, like a little child sort of thing, they will do it. And de Grolier was always very firm that the Ranganathan's principles did not accord with Cartesian principles. That's, as a Frenchman, I am naturally Cartesian, I've known him say more than once. And so he found it difficult to accept this, I was going to say materialist. That wouldn't be the right word, because de Grolier was a materialist himself. But it was a different way in a way, very pragmatic, whereas de Grolier wanted to be philosophical in sort of academic terms.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, from my, you know, McCarthyian background, one of the accusations that Metcalf used to make of Ranganathan was that he was not merely theoretical but mystical, and you know, he carried things into a level that was completely unrelated to the practical reality.
Yes, well, that certainly wasn't true.
Yeah.
And he was not of the European academic philosophical analysis traditions like Descartes and Leibniz and the Nachman. Spinoza, yes.
Yes, not Schopenhauer.
And Schopenhauer as well. But Spinoza particularly, yes. And he did have this, I suppose, I could never take Ranganathan as a mystic, when I, knowing him as I did quite well.
Yeah.
But he did have this class in the Köln classification, which was called something like mysticism, right in the middle. And he also had the inclination to codify processes a bit in relation to layers of spirituality, put it like his Abhupa pattern, like I've forgotten what they relate the word, what the APUPA mean, but it's, he used to describe it like the onion. The outer skin of the onion looks like that, and you think, well, that's an onion, and then you peel off the layer and you've still got an onion, but it's not the same onion.
Mm-hmm.
And so on until right you get to the heart of the matter, like I've written down there. And that is the essence and the truth, which is, I suppose in mystical terms, is given by revelation or intuition, like the idealist philosophers from Plato onwards, by intuition rather than by dirtying your hand at it.
Yeah.
But in practice, as I said earlier, the subject specialist could always cut non-professional analysis like anything. More than once people have said to me, well, why don't all libraries use this kind of arrangement? It's so simple.
Well, I suppose in one sense, classification, like the doing classification, is increasingly specific.
Yes, but that's conscious.
Yes.
Yeah, they took that decision in the Library of Congress. But then, of course, Dewey always had this.
Yes, he did.
Synthesis. It wasn't systematic.
No.
But it was very much the same approach as we had when we were talking about having to develop a new general classification. But there's no point in writing out everything more than once.
Mm.
So with Dewey, basically it was simple geographical and historical subdivision.
Yes.
But there are plenty of other occasions, right in the first edition, where he says divide like somewhere else. Mm. I always give the strikes in the mining industry, which perhaps were occurring in 1876. The amalgamation with the IIS.
Okay, that is interesting.
Yes. Well, that started after the war, when the Library Association had a university and research section, completely dominated by the older universities.
And the next one?
And but it was the only thing that had the word research in it. And a number of friends who were in the UNR section were in special libraries. There was this conference of the UNR section in Cambridge in, I think, 1950. And coming back from that conference, a group of us sitting in one of those carriages with two sides, and we talked the whole way about forming a new section of the Library Association which would involve librarians from industry, special libraries and so on, government libraries, and the Library Association, and would join those people with the specialist departments of the great public libraries like Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield and so on. Now Sheffield was giving a good information service to the local steel industry and had a cooperative system going, so there were a lot of experience. So we decided that we would submit a proposal to the LA to form this section, and ever since it has been growing more and more towards the information retrieval and dissemination documentation by mechanized systems, computers and the microfilm in the early days, yes. Of course, that sort of thing, in order to solve the space problem and the need for specialist libraries like Metal Box to be able to draw on large collections in the same way as the classification systems of specialist subjects wanted the rest of the world available. Mm-hmm. There's a very, very strong parallel, and we succeeded in doing that, and we held a conference in, I think it was 1952, which set this up and set up a number of local groups, London, South East, North West, North Midlands and so on. Each group was based either on the local city library, or if there was a big industry like Boots in Nottingham, for example, the librarian of Boots in Nottingham was very much a key member in that area. So this then really introduced to the Library Association the fact that there were people who were running these small specialist libraries who weren't members and had never taken any Library Association exams. Parallel with that grew up the growth of the independent library schools, and eventually setting, like University College before the war, well, since 1920s, setting their own qualification. University College always had its own diploma, which was recognised by the LA. All the other schools at that time took the LA exams, but then there grew up another set of library schools based on universities who wanted their own qualifications, like UC. And so there were these parallel movements going on, bringing into the Library Association types of library and librarian who had not been all their lives in the public library, which the Library Association, although it was founded by British Museum Library, Oxford and Cambridge librarians, as well as London, boroughs, Westminster and big cities, Birmingham, Manchester, it had always been dominated wholly by the public librarians, and this movement still really hasn't succeeded, but it has, to my mind, it has paved the way for this amalgamation.
Because Faraday was instrumental in having the Institute set up, wasn't
he? Yes, absolutely. He was it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think understood too that there was some move to get ASLIB to adopt a sort of an accrediting, examining function like the LA that would make it like the Institute, and it declined, I think. Is that right?
Well, I think the basic reason for that, in my view, is that ASLIB is an organisation of organisations, whereas the Institute and the LA are organisations of individuals. Yeah. And always, I'm pretty sure that that's why Jason formed his Institute, in order that there would be an organisation for individuals who did not choose to call themselves librarians, though they were the advanced guard of librarianship into the 20th and 21st centuries.
Yes, I think that's helpful, yes.
Yes. And at the same time, the people like the technical and the commercial librarians in Manchester, for example, were both doing that sort of work, exactly that sort of work. They were collecting the periodicals, they were analysing them, they were dishing out information, they were acting as information points for local industry and commerce, and the fact that they worked inside a public library didn't really alter the case. But that's what Jason wouldn't recognise, because he thought that if they worked in the general library, they must be generalists and not specialists.
Right. Well, also, he had this thing, too, that they had to have a science degree, wasn't it? So that these information scientists were themselves qualified in science in some way.
Yes, yes. One or two of them were absolute nuts. They really were no good, whatever.
Yeah.
They were rejected. We used to pull Jason's leg and say, well, you couldn't do science, so you had to be an information officer. Yeah. Right, of course, poor Jason, he could take it, but he was an innocent. He really was the original innocent, and the pure scientist. He would have gone to the stake in the Middle Ages without a tremor. I loved Jason dearly. But we never agreed on this point.
No. Well, the Institute itself apparently would seem not to have flourished all that much anyway. If we're in this kind of situation, I mean.
Yes, yes, I think that may be true. I have not been party to any of these negotiations.
No. Do you have continued involvement with the LA as a past?
Yes, but long ago. Only as a trustee of the Benevolent Fund.
Yes.
But I dug out, when this was first merger was first in the record, I dug out a mimeographed paper that I wrote 30 years ago probably, and it was called A Proposal for a British Association of Library and Information Associations.
Uh-huh.
And it said all those things.
It's the business of territories, and you know, people establish territories and then they can't get around them.